Gonna rock these chains. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution. And now, here's a double shot from our featured artist today, Emily Femgen. And stay tuned for that interview. It comes up right after these songs.
Blue.
was Emily Femgen from her brand new release, and we got Emily on the line. Hey, Emily, how are you?
I'm all right. How are you?
I'm doing pretty good, you know. Now, this is your first time on the show, and we always like to give our fans this opportunity to really get to know who you are. And the best way to do that is to look at your journey, how you got to where you are today. So give us the story of Emily Femgen.
Okay. Well, I was born in 1984, and I started as a kid. I always wanted to be a performer, and I started wanting to be an actress. So I did some acting as a kid, and I was real interested in musical theater. I was born in Denver. And then we moved to New York in 2000, and around then is when I shifted my interest to songwriting. I got really into Lou Reed. He is my favorite guy, and I got a four-track, and I was a really reclusive teenager, and I would just write and write and do covers, and I formed a little band with my childhood friend called the Jelly Babies, and we would make funny little tapes. And then I moved back to Denver for a time, and I formed a band with my friend called the Language of Termites, and we did some albums and a tour, and I moved back here, and I started curating my own shows because I wasn't sure where to play or where I fit in. So I ended up doing a weekly show at Knitting Factory called Americana Monday. And in that process, I started writing a bunch and meeting a bunch of people. And that kind of formed who I am today.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about the new release. When you were putting this together, what was your goal for this?
Well, I had had this collection of songs simmering for the last about 3 years, which is a really long time for me to sit on songs. So I had just been really wanting to get them out. But my previous releases have been pretty DIY and just kind of like doing it quickly and just kind of posting it on Spotify and hoping my friends will listen. And this time I really wanted to make a legit studio album. And just, I just felt like these were my best songs and they just really deserved the full treatment. I wanted to make a really great Americana album because those were the albums I fell in love with as a teenager. And I think we did it.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about that process as a songwriter. When you sit down to write, you know, songwriters each have their way of tapping into the muse. Some are that Nashville mentality where songwriting is like a job and you have writing times and you make appointments for co-writing things. And others are more collectors and they collect bits and pieces and they lay it out and they, you know, they say there's a song there. What is your process when you sit down to write that allows you to tap into the muse?
It's a little bit of both of those things. Sometimes I'll have an idea and when I'm out and about and I'll write it down and then it will just flow out when I sit down, or sometimes I'll feel like I haven't written a song in a while and I better do it, or I'll hear some song that I want to copy. This collection of songs was written when I was, like, playing at least a couple shows a week, and I was working a couple jobs, and I was just, like, on the go all the time, and it seems easier for me to write songs that way. Throughout the pandemic, when I've had, like, nothing but time, it's been really hard for me to sit down and force myself to do it. So I think it just, like, a collect, you know, having all the life experiences and like stimulation really helps me. It's so elusive, but
okay. Well, no, I definitely understand. Now, writing lyrics is a very structured process. I mean, it's a craft. You know, the more you do it, of course, the better you get at it. And lyrics have a very structured format to it. You have to have a story, continuity, you know, rhyme, meter, all those things. And it's a certain side of the brain that really works out lyric. But melody's different. Some writers like to work off a groove. Others like the meter of the lyrics to suggest where the melody should go. Where do you find your melodies?
That's really hard to say. I haven't really thought about it. It just kind of, it usually all happens together. Like the melody and the lyrics usually occur at the same time. Occasionally I'll have a line, like Flower Weed on this album. I had the chord progression that I was working on something else for, and then I had some of the lyrics that I had was using a different chord progression on that wasn't quite working, and just for fun, I decided to mash the two together, and they worked out.
Okay.
I'm pretty intuitive about it. I just kind of go with the flow.
All right. You know, back in the early days when I used to write songs, you know, the tools that I had was a pen, a pad, and a rhyming dictionary and a thesaurus. You know, that was kind of the thing. You know, everything was pencil and paper. But today, you know, technology has really given the songwriter, you know, access to a lot of great tools, the cell phone for capturing those ideas that, you know, so you don't lose them. I can't tell you how many songs I've lost over the years.
Yeah, I can't imagine not having the voice memo.
Yeah, so what are some of the tools that you use when you write?
Well, actually, I am pretty analog. I'm pretty bad at technology. I feel like I break every computer I'm around. I write with pen and paper. But the voice memo on the phone is very useful because I can get the melody down. But it's not that different from, you know, when I was a teenager and I'd use a little tape recorder. That's it for me. I'm
okay.
Old school.
Now, when you sit down and write, you know, you have to get to that point where you have to put the pen down. You have to say the song is ready to go into production, allow the producer, the musicians, to kind of put their fingerprints on it. What do you do to determine that moment in a song's life?
Well, I'm kind of lazy, so I very rarely go back and tinker with a song. If I have a few verses and a chorus, I pretty much call it a day. And, you know, I know Dylan, like, rewrites and rewrites and... You know, I'd like to try that approach, but at the moment, I kind of feel like if I sit down to write a song and I don't finish it, then it's not a good song. That's how I work.
Okay, well, that's fair enough. All right. Now, you know, having a good song gives you something to say, but going into the studio creates the voice. It creates... It gives the song its life, its breath, its ability to connect with people. And every artist has their way of working in that environment to capture their sound. What is your process when you go into the studio that allows you to capture your sound?
Well, this is the first album where I feel like I have fully captured that, other than some previous tracks where it was just me and guitar. And I went into the studio with Hugh Poole to his studio, which is Excello Studio in Greenpoint. And I was really lucky that he wanted to work with me, and he got my vision. So he did all the hard work. And,
okay.
You know, the rest of it's pretty intuitive. I was introduced to him through my friend Lorraine Lecky, and I got her band, who also works with Hugh Poole. So Charles DeChance and Keith Robinson. And yeah, I mean, if you have good people, it's pretty hard to not make magic. And what I'm going for is I wanted something pretty straightforward Americana, so it's not that difficult to achieve if you have the right people.
Okay, so basically, did you kind of go in and just do it live in the studio, or did you track it? What was kind of that process?
We initially did it live, and then we tracked in the stuff that we needed to.
Okay.
So like, you know, my vocals, and then a few other little things. But yeah, we did the core of it live to have that energy.
All right. Now,
and it was lots of fun.
Good. Now, when you put out a product, you got to create your team, and you have to, find someone that can get you, some press and get it out the radio and create the buzz. And you're working with Patty DeVries from Devious Planet. Tell me a little bit about how that relationship began and how is it going?
Well, I was introduced to her through my friend Tom Shaner. Tom and I did a duet of one of his songs called Maybe I'll Fall in Love with You. And it was, people loved it. And then Tom shot this video for me to the song Flower Weed, which is on YouTube. Check it out. And he introduced me to her because he was like, you should get some publicity for this thing. And then I had never worked with PR before or anything like that, it's made a world of difference, and so she's helping me promote the whole thing. And I'm also working with a radio promoter, so it feels legit this time around.
Okay. Now, let's talk a little bit about the music industry. Now, you're a young artist, but, I grew up in the days of vinyl. I'm an old guy. To me, music and buying music was a very tactile experience. And mm-hmm. The last 20 years, we've been in the digital revolution, which has redefined the music industry several times over. And now we're at a point where the consumer that's out there really doesn't look at recorded music as a product.
Right.
It's a service now. It's available 24/7. It's on their phone. Mm-hmm. And you can listen to anything that's been recorded for, last 100 years at a flick of a finger. How has this shift in the consumer's perception of recorded music affected you as an artist?
I mean, I started, when I fell in love with albums and wanted to write songs, that was, the late 90s, early 2000s. So I was buying CDs and records, and I love the art of an album and looking at the liner notes and the pictures and everything. And that's what I can't break the thing of that. That's what I want to create. I forget that it's not still 2000. And as I said, I'm not too into technology. So, the instinct is kind of just to like ignore it, but it's important to lean into it and just do, go with the times. So in terms of putting out an album, it's not so important anymore that it's, a work of art as an album, which is important, but it's more singles, right? So
I think the single thing is kind of a misnomer. Because, if you're a consumer and somebody puts out a single and you go to their Spotify page and you say, oh, there's like three singles, there's not really a body of work there. Mm-hmm. They don't look at you with the same respect as an artist. You know what I mean?
Maybe, yeah. I mean, it depends on the person.
Well,
I don't know if the young people are listening to full albums. I genuinely don't know.
But they want, it's not that they're listening to full albums, but they want to have the ability to choose from a body of work.
Yeah, you know, that makes sense. Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
You look at Taylor Swift when she puts out a release, it's 20-something songs. She's playing the odds that out of those songs that, you know, a good portion of those are going to be playlisted. You know what I mean? So, you know, I have a little thing about the singles. Singles should be used to promote a body of work, not to be a standalone, you know?
Of course, yeah. I totally agree with that. A lot of my peers, you know, think the way we do and just, you know, love albums, and they'll just put out a whole album and it just sits there.
Well, yeah.
So, I've learned a lot about actually promoting the thing and releasing single by single, which I haven't done before.
Right.
So I am leaning more into the
For Spotify, it's important that you release singles, because each release is eligible to be submitted for playlisting on their list. So it's strategically important for Spotify to do it. You know, that's the strategy. So you do, you know, two or three singles in anticipation of the album, and then you get three chances there. And then when the album releases, that's a fourth shot that you get at possibly submitting to their, you know, This Week or one of their curated playlists.
Right.
Now, you know, I read an article recently where Spotify's growth in the market has started to slow down. And a lot of that, and what a lot of people are saying, and especially in this article, is that Spotify has a very centered kind of approach to delivering music. In other words, it's a passive approach. Here is the artist, here is the music. Pick the songs you like, put it in your playlist, and listen. And what the pandemic has done is it kind of has amplified the fans' need to be connected to the artist. Whether, you know, artists started doing live streaming, they started creating content, things like TikTok, Instagram, Twitter, you know, Facebook Live or Facebook itself. And what it said in the article is that in the future, the new platform or whatever platform that comes out next is going to be one that connects the artist and the fan together. You know, I mean, Spotify will give you analytics about your fans, but doesn't allow the fans to connect to you and to your content, to your, you know, so they can learn about you almost reality show wise of, you know, what you do on your off days, you know, what you had for breakfast. You know, you take a picture and put in. Yeah. So, you know, it would be like putting Spotify together with TikTok, Instagram, and Twitter. You know what I mean?
Yeah, it seems like the natural way it's going to go.
So do you think that that's a good idea, something that you could find yourself participating in?
I mean, I love Dylan and Lou Reed and cool rock stars who have an air of mystery, and I feel like we're in a time of oversharing, and it's kind of a turnoff to me. But I get it, because when I was a teenager, I was, you know, on the message board talking to my heroes. So I get it, but I also think it's weird.
Well, it is weird, but it is that, you know, the progression of the time. Now, I've met Lou Reed, you know, and be honest with you, if he had access to this during his career, he was kind of grumpy anyway, but I think he would have used that platform to kind of get his grumpiness out. You know what I mean?
I sold him a movie theater ticket
Oh, you did? All right.
Yeah, he was very polite. Also, I do want to say, not to like, sorry to interrupt your thought.
That's okay.
I saw him do a New York Times talk. I don't even know what year that was, but it was when like Napster was just starting to get big. And he was very against it. And he was talking about how Velvet Underground made no money from those records. And Sterling Morrison died penniless. I always think about that.
Well, you know, the music industry is not exactly forgiving, let's put it that way. And, you know, we, as much as we want to rail against Spotify and streaming, and it's a reality. The consumer now has embraced this. So it's now up to us as artists to figure out, how do we monetize this?
Yeah.
If we can develop, or a new platform develops that treats the artist equitably, and if we have to create more content, whether it's music videos or live streaming or whatever the case may be, to put butts in the seat, to create that experience, then that's what we have to do, you know? It's a different world now that we're in.
Yeah, and there's, of course, benefits, because you're able to get your stuff out. Anybody can get their stuff out.
Right. I mean, it's not like in the days of Lou Reed, where he needed a record company. You had to go into an expensive studio, you know, and of course the record companies were, you know, screwing them, you know, left and right, you know. So, you know, those days, you know, as much as they may have hated it, they lived within those days. You know what I mean? Now, as we get out of this pandemic, and, you know, we're starting to get back into doing live music again, a lot of artists have come up to, you know, certain challenges getting back out there and performing again. What are some of the challenges that you're facing as you move forward and start going back to live performance?
Well, the pandemic has made me reassess how I'm doing it, because I was playing a bunch. Like, I was playing multiple nights a week and just saying yes to everything and just getting any stage time I could. But now, with the more professional approach, I'm thinking that I'll probably just do one big show every couple months. So that, you know, that's kind of like my mentality has changed, but also there's the, you know, the Delta variant and all that. But that's not why I'm not out there taking as much stage time as I can. So it's kind of aligned for me. It's a bummer. I'm hoping that I can do like a promo tour for this album, and I don't know yet if I'm going to be able to go to the radio stations or not. And I really hope people come to my show at Knitting Factory on September 23rd. I'm worried about that I won't have enough people there like I usually do, that I'm not like going out enough and promoting it. That's about how that it's affected me, but it did allow for me to have the time to make this thing and like slow down, and I've made the most of it.
Okay. Now, you know, one of the things that I found interesting about what COVID-19 has brought to the table for the independent artist is that it forced them to go out there and create content. And what that did is that, now, you know as well as anyone, you did a lot of performing before COVID hit. There's a lot of times you would go to a venue and you may have 10 people show up, half of them are blood relatives, and they're all watching television. You know, so live music had its challenges.
Mm-hmm.
But there is a huge potential music fan base that really didn't have that frame of reference of going to a smaller venue and watching music being created in the moment. They would go to the bigger shows. They would see, you know, artists where the music sounded just like the recording, and they would, you know, the excitement would be in the pyrotechnics and the costume changes and the choreography and the lights. But going to a venue and watching music being created in that moment by musicians is a different kind of experience. And what COVID-19 did is that it brought a lot of independent artists onto the internet, which infiltrated that world that this potential fan base lives in, and brought that experience to them in this world. And it also allowed independent artists to work their social media to create almost a reality show kind of celebrity, you know, where they people started connecting with them on a personal level by what they were doing and the kind of things that they were putting up on the internet. People wanted to feel like they were connected. So now when this new fan base passes a marquee and they see the name on there and they say, oh, I've seen that person on Twitter or TikTok or Instagram or Facebook or whatever, and, you know, maybe we should go see them live. Do you think that there may be a resurgence of live music coming to us after the pandemic has subsided?
I'm hoping so. I'm hoping that people have a renewed excitement about it. I initially tried to do a bunch of live streaming things, but it just doesn't, you know, as I said, I'm not that good around technology, and it just wasn't the same thing for me. It's not the same energy, obviously.
Oh, so, yeah, definitely.
I didn't do a lot of that, but I do think, like, putting out content during this time, people have watched more, and I have reached a little bit of a wider audience. And I also think that that maybe people are craving more kind of like folky stuff, like some kind of more like organic feeling stuff after all this, and they want kind of a more experience in terms of live shows, I hope.
Well, I hope so as well.
Mm-hmm. Be nice.
Well, you know, I really appreciate you coming on the show and talking with us, and it's been a real pleasure.
I appreciate you.
And we're going to give everyone out there a double shot from your brand new release, and you guys may want to just kick back, open a glass of a bottle of wine, and just enjoy this. And you know what? Open the window. Yeah. Let the neighbors in on it.
Yeah, play it loud.
Try to pull through. Oh, I did. To the test. God bless the babies and the flowers and the daisies and the tightness in my chest. Can't you tell?
rock the shade. Gonna scream my name. Make you shout now, honey. Gonna make you shout.
Whether you're an independent artist looking to take their career to the next level, or you're a fan that just loves to discover new artists and new original music, Making a Scene has exactly what you're looking for. For the indie artist, we have articles on music business, gear reviews, recording techniques, and interviews with industry professionals. For the fan, we introduce you to new artists every day with our in-depth artist interviews and insightful CD reviews. Nobody gives you more. Making a Scene truly is the number one resource for the indie artist and the fans that love them. Go to makingascene.org and become part of the indie revolution.
Shout now, honey.